Americans and the leaders who hold power, right? The prime ministers, the presidents, the whatever they are, you're talking about the people with power in the world. You're saying that their actions and their behavior with respect to their leadership roles parallels their personal upbringings?
Doesn't parallel
family life?
I'd say it's rooted in their experience growing up, what they were learning, what they were taught, ethical, moral, what their values are established by what they observe, what they are rewarded for, what they are punished for, what they are encouraged to do, how much, what do they have to do to defend themselves, to defend their persona growing up? What do they learn growing up?
So this is where the psychology enters in. So I think what you're suggesting is that leaders such as Netanyahu or perhaps the leaders of Hamas, who you characterized earlier as not striving for peace, but rather striving for power over.
Personal aggrandizement. Personal accomplishment.
Oh, personal, right. You're saying that this is something they've learned in their families as children growing up?
Yeah, if not in their families on the streets or from society around them. It's no different from any gang leader, Al Capone or Putin, or they just choose to support life as opposed to alienate life.
You say that by never accepting the reality of the new nation and the land, the Palestinians continually lost war after war and experienced diminished self-determination. Now, this, I think, is, we're changing gears slightly to talk about this. I think that could be controversial from several perspectives. So Let me play devil's advocate here without implying that I'm taking a personal position in opposition to yours, but I want to play the critic here.
Okay.
It sounds like you're either affixing blame or responsibility, at least, to Palestinians for not accepting Zionism, for not accepting the establishment of the state of Israel. And so the result of the failure of the Palestinians to accept the reality of the establishment of the state of Israel caused them to lose war after war and suffer from diminished self-determination. So it sounds to me, and you can refute what I'm saying or argue against what I'm saying, sounds like you are affixing responsibility, or at least partial responsibility, to the Palestinians for an unrealistic refusal to accept the state of Israel. And the implication is that had the Palestinians accepted the reality of Zionism and the state of Israel, they might have been able to negotiate or achieve some sort of different outcome, which would have been not losing wars and having more self-determination. So I think that's a controversial statement, and I'm not arguing it. I'm inviting you to defend that, the assertion. First of all, do you agree with me that with the characterization that that's what you're arguing?
No.
Okay.
I think the word, so number one, I heard you use the word blame, a responsibility. My attempt was simply to look at outcomes without blame, without responsibility, without just objectively describing what took place. So for example, in 1947, partition was determined by the United Nations. And the borders, the boundaries between the Jews in Palestine and the Arabs in Palestine the Palestinians, both Christian and Muslim Arabs, were delineated. And they were drawn up. And in 1948, and those areas are quite, quite different from today, post 67, even post 2000, as Israel settled more and more of the West Bank. And what happened, and so when these maps are described, there's a map presented which shows Israel, or which shows the mandate area before 47, what was mandated by the UN, and compare it through the state, through the years, to the current, most current situation. And you'll see that Jewish population has increased multifold, and the Palestinian state, as it exists now, shrinks. Had the Palestinians and the Arabs not declared war on Israel and said, okay, we will live with what is, the Palestinian state would be far larger than it is now. And that had Egypt and Nasser not built up its forces in Sinai in 67, then the 67 war would never have taken place. Had Nasser not asked the United Nations troops that were separating Israel and Egypt, had Nasser not asked them to withdraw, had the UN not withdrawn their troops, there wouldn't have been a 67 war. And it would have been the same borders as there was in 48. By launching wars, there's no blame here. It's just a reality that Israel has a, for whatever reason, Israel has proven itself to have better skills at creating armies and forces. All kinds of that. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that Palestinians are to blame. I'm just saying that was it. Now, there's a story behind why it happened the way it happened. And my suggestion is that from when immigration, large-scale immigration began in the late 1800s, carried through the early 20th century, you had a tribal society. It was a clash of civilization. You had a tribal society meeting up with a Western society, urban society, technologically more capable because of the organization. The organization of the Palestinian people was such that they didn't have the wherewithal to counter the sophistication of the Jewish immigration. And it's, you know, maybe I'm wrong. I'm not saying there's any blame here. I'm just looking at it and saying things took place that resulted in what they resulted in. The Mufti of Jerusalem from 1927, I think, till 1936 or something like that, sided with the Nazis. Arafat sided with Saddam Hussein. These aren't beliefs. These are just facts. And they have outcomes. That's all that I'm saying.
So one of the important nuggets that I'm getting from what you're saying, Zelig, and I'm transcending the traditional argument of who's right and who's wrong, which I think is what you're doing. You're making a distinction between affixing responsibility in the sense of judgment, in the sense of who's right and who's wrong and who's justified and who's not justified. You're not advocating that sense of responsibility. What you're saying is that you simply are talking about cause and effect. In a way, it's like you're being a scientist describing the laws of physics or causal chains that we find in nature, which aren't good and they aren't bad. They're simply things that happen. And that's a very important concept because I think that's lost on many people these days. It's certainly lost on politicians. It's lost on the very people and leaders we're talking about who grew up in families which were oriented toward right and wrong and power over. And not just leaders, but I think many common people today, citizens, peers of mine certainly, have a lot of trouble viewing conflict in a non-judgmental way and simply describing events and the effects of those events.
Yeah.
And let me just say from a personal standpoint that that's a very difficult situation, because tell me if you've had this experience, Alec. I will be trying to explain to somebody my view of cause and effect in a way that you just did, similar to what you just did. This is what happened, and this is the reaction, or this is the effect of what happened. It's very difficult for people to hear that without reading into my analysis a judgment, without reading into it a taking of sides. And that's a very difficult situation, because people get triggered by even my expression of a cause and effect relationship, because by merely expressing that this caused that, people get triggered and they say, why are you taking the side of X, or why are you taking the side of Y? And all I'm trying to do is describe cause and effect. And it sounds to me like that's what's happening here. That's what you're doing. You are simply stating that
So
because of what happened, another thing happened without taking sides. Is that right?
Without taking sides. So here's another example of that from a different perspective or whatever. Israelis complain about the Intifada, about the uprising of Palestinians on the West Bank, about terrorism. And it's terrorism because the people who commit the acts of violence, of bombing, et cetera, are not wearing a uniform. If they wore a uniform, then it wouldn't be terrorism. Israelis will complain about the terrorists. It's the same deal. Why are terrorists generated as terrorists? It's the only way they know that they can express their yearning for whatever, independence, meaning, national state. They are being suppressed. They are coming from a power over, power under relationship. And the only way that they can think of changing that relationship is through violence. And that's what Frantz Fanon wrote about back in the 60s, I believe. So it's not an uncommon, that's what rebellion has been all along. And that's why they say one person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist. Even the heads of the Israeli, some of the heads of the former heads of Israeli security would say, we did the same thing when Britain was exercising power over the Jewish immigration. You had people wreaking violence against the British.
Some people would not be able to hear the statement you just made, and I'll repeat it as I heard it, that the violent acts of Palestinians, which are labeled terrorism, may be the only way that those people have to express the fact that their needs aren't being met. They're yearning for self-determination. Many people would hear that statement as a pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel, and perhaps even anti-Semitic statement, because they would hear that statement as a defense or a justification for terrorism, as opposed to a judgment-free attempt to describe cause and effect. Is that correct? Do you agree with that distinction?
No, but I certainly am grateful for your analysis of that and bringing that up, because here's what was missing in my previous comment, which is, or your words as well. You just set this up as an issue of cause and effect. There is a third element that I think is really important, which is the cause stimulus to action and strategy. So maybe there are four parts to the equation, which is the cause. In this case, let's just say it's a cause for national identity. That's the cause. The lack of national identity is the reason that everything is following through. There's no way of manifesting national identity. That's the cause, the lack of national identity, lack of protection. The stimulus is experiencing one side attacks the other. And so therefore, hang on a minute. So the cause is the lack of identity. How do you address the lack of identity? That's the strategy that you choose. So you can choose terrorism, you can choose armed conflict, whatever, you can choose negotiation, talking. These are all strategies. And the outcome will be the effect. The outcome of the strategy that you use to meet the needs will be the effect.
Zelek, let me offer an alternate and perhaps simplified version of your stimulus response, or your elaboration or your correction of the stimulus response model. So, and then you can tell me what you think of it. So the stimulus response model by itself is inadequate or insufficient because it doesn't allow for any choice. It doesn't allow for anything between the stimulus and response. It fallaciously or erroneously suggests that the response is predetermined and is caused only by the stimulus. But you're suggesting that there's at least one and perhaps several steps in between the stimulus and the response. So let me offer a simplified version, which is that we would insert something between stimulus and response. I'll call it organization. We could also call it interpretation. We could call it choice. So let me give you a hard example of that. So let's say the events that precipitated this current war, that is the Hamas fighters infiltrating Israel, murdering people, let's call that the stimulus. And let's say the response was IDF or Israel declaring war on Hamas, IDF finally invading Gaza. So what we're seeing now is the response. So let's say that the actions of the IDF, the actions of Israel in response to that Hamas attack on Israel was not necessary, not necessary in the sense of there could have been another response. It wasn't predetermined that the response must have been and only could have been the response that we actually witnessed. It was a choice made by Israel. Israel could have made, would have been logically possible for Israel to respond differently. That middle zone between stimulus and response is what's at stake here. It's what we're talking about on this show. It's how does one respond to events that's consistent with what you're suggesting are better criteria for responding to stimuli, criteria having to do with understanding the needs of people rather than trying to achieve power over. So I'm trying to kind of bring things to a full circle here, which is how does either side or any side, how do people respond to stimuli in a way that's consistent with a agenda for peace rather than an agenda for power over? So I'm bringing it all together here. In this middle step between stimulus and response, in this organizational step, how do we overcome our family upbringings, which perhaps taught us to see the world as a modus vivendi, to see the world as a power play, as trying to get power over the other as a way of getting needs met without regards for the needs of others? How in this middle stage between stimulus and response can we take into account these principles that we've been talking about, Zelek, on this show, And how would there be a different response which might be more likely to lead to real peace? That's really the, right? That's really the gold here. That's what we're striving for, if we're correct and if you're correct in some of your philosophical interpretations here. So this would apply not only to Israel, but also to the Palestinians. But I'm now using the example of the Israeli response to the attacks by Hamas. How might have Israel responded differently, which may have been in alignment with a strategy for peace, in your sense of the word peace, meeting the needs of all parties, rather than the response that we got from Israel?
The war and violence, is that right?
What's an alternative strategy? Given the stimulus, given what happened,
right.
And I'm just pulling one example. I mean, we could also talk about many other points in history, right?
Yeah. You can't answer that. I can't answer that question in the light of the current conflict between Israel and Hamas or Israel and Hezbollah, because there are elements. There are elements in the relationship that are long-standing, historical, perhaps even genetic, or I'm not sure what, social. Taking that aside, how does looking at one's own personal relationships, if you have violence in your relationship, first of all, you have to be able to stand up back and look at your relationships, whichever one you're going to look at, and ask, is this a power over or a power with relationship? Is there satisfaction on all parties? Do you want it differently? If any individual wants it differently, then you have to do something different. And my experience has been the only way to do it differently is to be educated, to have an education that gives me the tools and the skills to achieve what I'm asking for. And all of that begins with the concept of intention, not an intention in a very deep, not simply a plan of action. In English, intention usually means a plan of action. I want this, and these are the steps to take. In other, perhaps more philosophical or mystical terms, intention has more to do with sense of self, sense of being, that which is unconscious, coming from a multi-sensory perception, body, mind, and spirit. That's where intention is formulated. When you formulate an intention at that level, then that's part of getting to the outcome that you want. So I guess it's about education.
So would it be fair to say, sort of in summation, that without taking sides and without affixing blame or without judgment, you believe, Zelik, that the decades-old, at least 100-year-old conflict between Israel and the Arabs is a result of perhaps missed opportunities or a result of the leaders on each side acting from their own personal childhood, growing up experiences, not in the interests of peace in the sense of meeting the needs of all parties, or not in the sense of peace in the sense of power with, but rather power over. And that would apply to both the Arab and Palestinian reaction to the establishment of the State of Israel. It might also apply to Israel's response to the more recent Hamas attack. Would it be fair to say, from your point of view, that what we are witnessing is a conflict that continues and continues and continues because of the failure of the leaders to overcome their own personal psychology and to learn, to be educated with, to acquire a new vision, which is peace in the sense of meeting the needs of all sides of power with. Is that a fair summation of your view?
Well, I heard you throw in all the leaders in the same pot, and not all leaders act the same. Not all leaders are coming from the same source or whatever. So, for example, Sadat, who under Nasser was promoting war, the destruction of the state of Israel. And at the same time, he signed the first peace accords with Israel. And then he was shortly thereafter assassinated. That speaks to me volumes. In Israel, you had Rabin, who with much disgust shook hands with Arafat at Camp David. And then he was assassinated. I wouldn't say all the politicians are acting in the same way. There are no peace movements in any of the Arab countries, any of the Muslim countries. There are no peace movements that promote finding a way to have peace with Israel. Only in Israel has there been consistently a movement for such a statement of fact. And it makes me wonder, why? How? What does it take instead?
However, just to be fair, I think as a statement of fact that that peace movement in Israel is very small and somewhat marginalized.
The more conflict goes on, the smaller it became. It wasn't all that small earlier on. It became smaller as violence broke out. That might exactly be why there's no peace movement on the Palestinian side. Maybe there's just people don't see the possibility given the way Israel responds to acts of, let's call it civil disobedience, which includes violence and killing. So maybe it's the same thing. I don't know. But I also know that assassinations are far more prevalent in the Arab side, whether it's in Palestine or the other countries.
Thank you very much, Zelek Siegel. Thanks for sharing your ideas, and I appreciated your paper, which I think provides a refreshing, perhaps hopeful perspective on the conflict in the Middle East. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca.
It's Leslie, host of Typically Tuesdays on Mondays at 3 p.m. I've been making radio at CJSF 90.1 FM for 6 years. And it's time. I'm going to tell you a little secret about my success. Are you ready? It's you! It's you, dear listener. Without your curiosity and commitment to seeking out innovative ideas, underrepresented voices, and alternative radio programming, I'd be shouting out into a void, probably quite literally. And so from me and all of the other hosts at 90.1 FM, no, you make us radio. You make us great radio. On behalf of all of us at CJSF, thank you.